Accession number 13856, reel 6.
Here, reel 6.
Reel 6. Well, we're talking about the return of all the tank landing ships and headquarters ships that were sent out to the Far East and arrived at Bombay only to be told that they had to return to England again because they weren't going to do much war out there until D-Day had been fixed for England, for the invasion of France. So I met Sarrell, my old friend Sarrell, and we had a bit of fun. We stayed in old Bombay. When we got to Delhi after Bombay, we stayed in old Delhi, the Victoria Hotel, a lovely archaic remains of ancient Britain, still with honourable Indian gentlemen running it. And I discovered the telephone number of the transport pool and immediately summons the transport to take us from Old Delhi to New Delhi headquarters every day that we needed. And Sarah and I used to sit in luxury in the back of a limousine driven by a beautiful uniformed Sikh, passing brigadiers and almost generals on bicycles pedaling along the road, and we were sort of waving to them, just sort of giving them encouragement. It's a wonderful way, if you know the right numbers, to convince the Indians that you're a very important person. So we whiled away the time in Delhi and then caught the train back to Bombay. This is when I started my lust for train driving again. So I stoked the train from, it was called the Rawal Pindi Express. And the great thing is that at a stop, of course, the place was filled with monkeys and Indians crawling all over the place. But if you wanted to transfer from your cooler to the engine, you had to get out when the train stopped and run up to the front end, clutching a bottle of whiskey, and talk the driver into having you do some stoking. That's why I said I wanted to stoke the train. So I used to plant the whiskey in the driver's hand and say, give me the shovel. So we shoveled our way down until the next stop when we thought we'd drunk enough and stoked enough. So it's a wonderful way of getting a little experience of steam-driven engines. That was that. So eventually I flew, got back to Colombo.
I think you became Commander F at China Bay.
And then to give me something to do, they sent me out to be Commander Flying at China Bay, yes, which was run by the Air Force at that stage. China Bay, of course, is in Trincomalee, which was going to become the fleet anchorage of the Southeast Asia Fleet. Clem Moody, Admiral, who was at least a knowledgeable aviator. So I was out there. I had a very good time as Commander Air for about 2 or 3 months. I had my own light aircraft, Stinson Reliant. I used to have the greatest of fun, was fly people around there. And also at this time, I met my wife Barbara, or she was a third officer Wrens, the first fighter direction officer ever to emerge from the Wren ranks. And since I was still on the staff of Renasio, I had the job of selecting an alternative fighter headquarters or fighter direction headquarters in case the RAF one got blown up. I said, we need a naval backup, so I had to pick who was going to be the Wren fighter direction officer to take over in the case that Bunny Stone's outfit got blown up. So I had them all lined up, these rather lovely girls, about five of them. And I picked what I thought was the most beautiful one. And she called me Sir, if you please. Yes, sir, she said. When I then said, you must come and meet all the fighter pilots, the Spitfire pilots down at Rat Milano. I had my own staff car. I found she'd scuttled into the back of a three-tonner, and I said, Third Officer Grange, she said, sir, I said, out of that truck, I said, you're coming with me. So she said, yes, sir, or something like that. And that night, I drove her back and took her to the Silver Fawn, which we used to call the Septic Prawn, in Colombo. And we never looked back. She's still here. That was a long time ago.
Then you became wing leader.
Oh, yes. Well, then you see, before Barbara arrived on the scene, I got really tired of gazing hungrily at the few sort of specimens that were available for our leisure times. And so I thought I'd better go back into operational flying, and I put in to do this in the chief of staff, a chap called Harvey. What a splendid chap he was. He said, I think you're mad. And I said, I know. But I can't. I'll be madder still if I stay here. So he said he approved my application, as a result of which, of course, I then started to fly the operational aircraft we had out there, like Corsairs. And then, believe it or not, an air group came out that was rather tired, and Bill Sears, who had been my old commander, flying at the Ovalton many years back in 1942, turned up, and he said, I've got my air group, or the air group from my ship, is at Alundapet in southern India, and you must go up there and sort that lot out. So I did. I flew up to Alundapet, and we became the air defense of southern India. Now, I've been air defender of Gibraltar earlier in 1941, and now at last I was the air defender of the whole of southern India. I thought this was coming up in the business. Well, I'd only got 24 Corsairs to do the air defense, because there was no air threat, really, because the Japanese had withdrawn by that time. So that was fun. So with Alundapet, and of course the business of in Alundapet, I hope you don't mind these little stories,
no,
because it had a tremendous influence on us, you know, because they had stuff called Perry's Gin. I don't know whether you like gin or not, but Perry's gin wasn't bad. It's all made from corn or maize or something like that. And they did it very well up in Alundapet. And you could buy it for some quite ridiculous sum in great big demijohns. And so I said to the pay up there, wardroom sec, I said, I'm coming up next week and I want a 4-gallon jar of it. No, the 4-gallon jar is quite a, you know, it's a thing about that this big. And so when I arrived up there and did my stuff with the chaps and told them whatnot, it then came time to go back to Colombo. Question is, I was flying a Corsair, and where did I put this damn thing? Well, I thought of taking the guns out or strapping it on the wings. And there's only one place to put it, and that was between my legs, between the seat and the control column. When I put it in there, you know, because the Corsair is very commodious, you had to reach forward to grab the thing, the joystick. I pulled it back, and it just gave me about half a degree of elevation on my tailplane. And I didn't know I was ever going to get away with it. Anyway, using the actuating wheel, I flew back to Colombo, fear and trembling that, because I couldn't do any maneuvers, with a stick hard pressed back against this great demijohn of gin. So landing at the race course, which is where mostly where I was based, was a very wheely affair. I came in with a lot of flap and winding on the actuating wheel, which acts as tabs, which accentuates. I certainly didn't get the tail down, and but I ran along with the thing hard pressed against the gin. So the great thing was I got 4 gallons of gin. Now, that's 24 months' ration, all in one. So I said to Barbara, what are we going to do with this, all this gin? She said, well, have a party. I said, yes, I'm surely going to have a party. What are we going to celebrate? And I always say, then she said, that is what she said. She said, well, we could celebrate our engagement. Who did propose to who? I don't know. Anyway, I said, well, not a bad idea. So we had a tremendous party in the Colombo Club, which was very exclusive.
We've now reached...
And that's how I got engaged. And
that's June 1944.
That is in June 44, and we got married in October 44. I was in... by that time, I was wing leader of Victorious Air Group. I'd ceased to be commander flying at China Bay and all those things. And I'd become wing leader. And we were flying against the Japanese in Sumatra.
From HMS Victorious.
From Victorious, yes. Marvelous chap called Michael Denny, who became chairman of Camel Laird in due course. He was one of the few gunnery officers I really respected. And he was very kind to me, and he acted as father to the... We had the wedding on board Victorious. We just... I've been off on an operation. I can't remember. I may have noted some of the... We did about four or five of these sorties out, and I think we were bombing some works or doing something. And on return... Moody or Vaughan by that time, who was in command of the carrier squadron, had special flying off detail to fly off one Corsair. That was me. I'd been up all night getting fearfully plastered with all my squadron mates and so on, determined to make certain I was serviceable for the wedding ceremony in due course. I was no fit state, so I did a very rotten slow roll over the ships and disappeared to Colombo, to the race course, to recover. That was on the 22nd, I think, and on the 24th we got spliced in a church in Colombo. And then we had October. We had November with some more raids that went on, and finally we did rehearsals for... blowing up oil refineries and things.
But as wing commander, did you actually go out on the raid yourself?
Oh, yes. I flew as... I was the air admiral, so to speak. By that time, I'd been appointed air coordinator, which meant that I had direction of all the aircraft in the sky.
So these were ground attacks on Japanese targets?
No, these were bombers and...
Bay of Bengal.
I had fighter escorts, all the fighter escorts for the bombers, and although, of course, they operated independently, we had the ground attacks strafing the airfields to prevent Jap fighters from taking off, and also direction of the bombers. If they were saturating target A and target B was empty, I'd tell... the next wave of bombers to do B instead of A, and that was the plan. Didn't quite work out like that, but it doesn't matter. That was my job as air coordinator.
And you attacked the Nicobar Islands?
Oh, yes, Car Nicobar. In cement works, all sorts of extraordinary, stupid little targets. My criticism at the time was, of course, that having arrived, we destroyed what... The Japs were on the run. They hadn't much resources left. And instead of staying for three or four strikes, mind you, who are we to criticize? We didn't want to stay there any longer. We had to. But the Jap threat wasn't very great in Sumatra. Air threat, that was. Of course, there were a few of them. And, of course, they hadn't really intensified their kamikaze stuff. We should have stayed there. But then what you might argue, what... more good could we achieve? There weren't any really prime targets that would disrupt the Japanese war. We'd have to seek out individual, rather more tactical, not strategic targets. And I don't suppose blotting out a regiment here or an air defense system there or a shore battery somewhere else was really worthwhile, because we weren't planning an invasion of that particular bit of the country. So I suppose there was no much point in staying there, because there was no real target to go for, not substantial target anyway. So we used to rush out 600 miles there and 600 miles back, spent spend a day on operations in that area, and that was it. It was an awful lot of fuel we used. Of course, in Trinco we had fun. Did I tell you the story of Unicorn? It wasn't Unicorn anyway. It was one of our submarines in Trinco Harbour. One of our submarines came back after a cruise. And it was a Saturday afternoon, and I was on Unicorn because I'd just been landing trial landings of Corsairs and what was it, Seafires and things. And I was, I'll remember his name in a minute because he's recently died, was the captain of the ship. And while he was sunbathing on his flag deck, and I was sunbathing beside him, and there was a sudden awful bang noise, and we all sat up and saw. And we weren't quite certain what had gone on. Anyway, call away my boat, says the captain. So we call away his boat. And I went with him, because we hastily pulled on shorts and things. And we rushed off to a ship that was alongside, where there was a lot of noise going on and smoke and stuff. And we climbed up on board ship and met by the captain, who was shaking his fist with absolute fury. "How dare you," he said, "you devils. What have you done to my ship?" Well, poor old, he didn't know, Fancourt was his name, Fanny Fancourt. He didn't know what had happened. He said, "Well, what's happened?" He said, "Well, we've been struck by a torpedo." Apparently, one of our submarines was coming, had come back from patrol, and lying at anchor in their submarine pen, the petty officer was checking that all the tubes were empty. And, you know, anyway, one of them wasn't empty. One of them was not empty at all, and he'd fired it, and the thing had shot across the harbour and hit this tanker. Fortunately, it was no fire. Well, it wasn't a tanker anyway, so it didn't matter. Well, that's the first rather silly thing that happened in Trinco. The next thing was Vanguard. Not, it couldn't have been Vanguard. It was one of those old battleships. Anne Duke? No, couldn't have been her. Anyway, whichever one it was, Ramillies. It could have been all sorts of archaic pieces of ironmongery were sent out to do this war out there. It climbed in. At last, a floating dock had been built. God knows where it had been built. I think somewhere in the States or in England. It had been towed all the way out. Thousands of miles they'd towed this beautiful floating dock. At last it arrived in Trinco. Joy, joy forever. Or except amongst the sailors, of course, which in the old days, the nearest docking facility was in Cape Town. So that meant a lovely sort of relaxation, no war, go down to Cape Town. But the floating dock was going to change all that. So they put this Valiant. They put this damn great battleship into the thing and started pumping her out. Of course, they didn't pump it right, or some of the pumps failed or whatever went wrong. I don't know, but they got her half up. But the bows went on going up, but not the stern. So eventually the angle got so much that the whole ship slid off the shocks and shot back into the harbour again. Of course, it wrecked the floating dock. There was great jubilation amongst the sailors over that. You don't remember? I mean, I don't suppose it's recorded, is it, anywhere?
Never heard of it.
The disaster of the floating dock. And you think of the struggle they had to get it there. It didn't service one ship. It was scrap.
How long were you doing these operations from Victorious?
Oh, that went on until the end of the war, because I stayed in Vic all the way through the Pacific. So it was from where, about September, I suppose. September to December, August, September. And through the end of that year. And then we did a practice of bombing. Of course, we'd already done one. Pangalan Brangdan was an oil refinery we'd done in Sumatra. And then we went off on this Meridian. And we're referring to...
This is Operation Meridian January 1944.
Well, that was Palembang. Now, Palembang, of course, is one of the things that gets the ire of the RAF, or shall we say the Air Ministry, because already already there had been several attempts to put Palembang out of action, which had failed. They tried Mitchell's bombers, they tried all sorts of things, but none of them got the range to do it. So they rang up, you know, in those days, under Roosevelt, he had a thing called the Strategic Bomber Force, or B-29s. Do you ever hear about B-29s? They were super forts, as they call them, high altitude, long range. It was all frightfully hush-hush, weren't allowed to talk about it. Everybody who was not an essential weren't allowed on the air base. They landed at China Bay secretly. For about a week, they muttered around in small circles. Then one night, they all disappeared. Didn't come back again. But they went off to bomb Palembang. And, of course, this super, super weapon, they all missed the target. They didn't hit anything, as far as I can make out. So, in the end, here was this prime source of oil in Sumatra, southeast Sumatra, still intact. So they said, well, the only thing to do is do it the proper way, the daylight raid by the poor old fleet air arm. We'd done one or two of those horror things earlier on, in like the Tirpitz and daylight. I mean, a lot, you must have heard a few stories about the awful planning about daylight raids by slow and adequate aircraft. Well, the Palembang thing was quite different. We had Avengers. We got another silly story, but never mind. I'll finish the Palembang bit first. But we had Avengers, and we had Corsairs and Hellcats. And they all had endurance of 6 hours. 5 hours easy. With long-range tanks, more. 5 hours. You go a long way at 5 hours. As opposed to the 1 hour 50 that the CFARs had got. So they were, CFARs, quite useless in that Pacific War. When I say quite useless, for close defense. But it was a bore because you had to turn up into wind every 1.5 hours to change them round. Whereas we would stay and do our airborne thing for twice that length, if not longer. Anyway, as a daylight raid with 4 carriers, we had something like 160 aircraft, of which, say, 80 of them or 90 were bombers. And each bomber with, I think, 4,000 pounds of bombs and 80 fighters dispersed one way or another. And I was put in charge of the whole lot. Anyway, that's why I got my interest in it. In seeing that this is put in the in right perspective in history, because it was the first time that the Navy had sought to destroy a strategic target, which was quite inaccessible, when I say quite inaccessible, except for the B-29s, who prove ineffective, rather like the Vulcan raids in the Falklands, quite out of anybody's mind or imagination of any use whatsoever. And so we did 2 strikes. There were 2 refineries. We did Plageau one day, and a few days later we did Sanji Gurong. And I've got a lot of pretty vivid photographs, because I was taking photographs at the same time as trying to tell chaps which piece of the plant was still active and which it wasn't. It was a bit difficult with all that smoke about. So that side of it wasn't all that good. We lost a fair number of people, I suppose 5% or something. But the results were, of course, pretty dramatic. The thing was put out of action. So strategic-wise, I mean, this is the important thing. It just showed that naval air power, or the Navy, shall we put it more broadly, was able to strike where no one else could in those days. I'll say today with modern Arab planes with their in-flight refueling system. But still, unless you're going to use nuclear bombs, you're not going to achieve any great result by carrying, shall we say, 1,000, 2,000, 10,000 pounds of bombs over, say, 2,000 miles from what base you can get to, without being shot down or intercepted by guided missiles and all the rest of it. It's this very difficult equation. Not in those days, anyway, because they just couldn't get there.
Was there any enemy fight or opposition?
Oh, yes, yes. I shot down 4 Japanese during the 2 days that I was in that particular business. And we lost, I haven't counted them all. I think we lost about 20 aircraft.
What were the Japanese like to shoot down as compared with the Germans?
Oh, piece of you only got to look at a Japanese, he burst into flames. When I say that, I mean, say, you just point yourself generally at him, press the button, and he immediately blew up. They had no self-sealing tanks. Their planes were made mostly of wood, or maybe bits of tin with wood around them. And I've never seen aircraft just... One squirt and they blow up. I was very pleased because you saved ammunition and so on. Although I hated bringing ammunition back, I said, it costs a lot of money to get these bullets out here. I said, we're going to use them, every one of them. But it wasn't really necessary. I never had any trouble fighting the Japanese. We could outclimb them. For the first time, I love to tell you this, for the first time in the whole war, except when I was doing ramrods in sea fires, in Spitfires, that was, over France, it was the first time in the whole war I was totally in command of the air, not just all the air that was there, all our own friendly air, but there was no aeroplane could touch me. I could out-climb, I could out-fly, I didn't try it. Well, the Corsair was an absolutely marvelous aircraft. I could outmaneuver a great number of them, but one wouldn't like to try much thing. I could certainly outdive all the Japanese. And I got armor-plated glass and self-sealing tanks and all those usual things that just came ordinarily with our sort of stuff, whereas the Japs had nothing like that. So it was a tremendous relief that we were on top and they were getting the sort of dreadful treatment that we had to suffer in the early part of the war with inadequate aircraft. So really, when Harvey said to me, you're crazy to volunteer to go back flying, and I said, well, one of the remarks I'd said was, not because I was bored, I said, well, I'm senior enough now and I've been flying long enough to keep out of harm's way. And I said, all I'm going for is more rank and more gongs. And I couldn't have been more right because I never got touched, actually. I don't think I think I had one bullet hole in my aircraft in the whole of the rest of that war. So there was no great... I'm not saying that because I didn't go on ground strafing. I got a signal from Admiral Vaughan that under no circumstances was I to continue ground strafing because we lost a lot of people doing that. I didn't take much notice, obviously, but it didn't matter. So it was a completely changed war, apart from the fact that, of course, it's always a hazardous business war, but it was downhill war. That was it. And you couldn't lose. Then the kamikazes start. Of course, I've jolly jumped ship, but we've moved out of Palembang into the Pacific. When we haven't mentioned Ernie J. King's objections, did you know about them?
Admiral King of the
Ernie
US
J. King Navy. Was chief of the American Navy. In Nokia, I don't want any goddamn limeys around there. They'll always be a drag on the thing. Well, I didn't blame him from that point of view. The joke was that when we did get there, I've never seen Americans more eager to give you everything. They say, any guy goes up the sharp end, he says, he can have everything. Somehow, rather you than me, buddy. So that was great. But of course, that didn't go down with King very well. The other great thing was that